Do you want to talk about tennis first, or do you want to talk about your Raiders in Las Vegas? I'm going to give you the choice.
You know, Raiders in Las Vegas, is a road trip to Vegas doesn't sound so bad for Malibu. Just hopefully we'll be a little bit better. We got a mulligan season for my Warriors. And tennis, you know, obviously with the pandemic, we've been on hold for about 5 months. And hopefully, fingers crossed, besides a few exhibitions that we got going now, we'll actually get some tournament play this summer.
When it comes to your Warriors having the offseason, we know, of course, Brad, that our Raptors beat your Warriors in the NBA Finals. And a lot of people down south, Brad, saying, oh, you know, if the Warriors were healthy, they would have beat the Raptors. Where are you on that? Because we are 100% saying, no, a championship's a championship. There's no asterisks involved here.
I mean, there's no doubt that you guys earned it, but I'm convinced if the Warriors were completely healthy, we'd have won easy 4-1. I mean, the Cavs were a better team with Durant. There was no way that they were going to lose that series. And I still think if Klay Thompson doesn't get hurt in game 6, Warriors win game 6 and win game 7 without Durant. Warriors are a tremendous team. Toronto earned it, but the Dubs had more talent. I think that you guys, improved dramatically, and the coach was a big change for you guys.
Yeah, it certainly was a lot of fun. Getting back to your Raiders for a sec there, Brad, this is a season for Derek Carr, for your quarterback, that lots of people have been dumping on. Stats-wise, he's not as bad as people think, and this is a big year for him, for that division, for that team. What's your outlook? What's your gut telling you about your Raiders this season?
To be honest, I'm a huge Raider fan. I'm not a Derek Carr fan. I mean, we've had 6 years with him. The only person in the history of the NFL to lose more games in 6 seasons as a quarterback, and it was one more, was his brother. Granted, he played in Houston, which was the expansion team. And I'm not a fan. And unfortunately, you know, we got another season with him, but he just doesn't throw the ball downfield. He's all about dink and dunk and, you know, getting completions. And on third downs, he chucks the ball on the ground when he feels any pressure. As long as he has a perfect pocket, he's okay, but he can't wiggle in the pocket, and he just is unwilling to take risks down the field. So I'm not a huge fan, and I think we're stuck with him, but I would hope at some point we could move on from him. That's my humble opinion.
Well, and Marcus Mariota's there. It'll be super interesting if he sees the field at all for those Raiders. Brad, obviously, you're a professional tennis player. We all watch you on ESPN. You're a current tennis coach. Some of your players you've coached, Agassi, Roddick, Murray, and your new podcast, Winning Uglier with Brad Gilbert, is just to help people better their tennis games. Are you at the point where when you're at the club or you're anywhere or you're driving by the local park and you see people play and they're hitting a couple balls, right away you kind of look for things in their game to kind of, you know, potentially even help them out? And what's the most common mistake the recreational player makes on the court?
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun getting this podcast going, Winning Uglier. Especially with my son, he's got the hard part. He's doing the editing and producing. He's like, Dad, man, you got the easy part. You just be you and talk, man. It takes me forever. I'm like, let's just do it live, eliminating all the editing. But when I go to the club, especially to do this show, just like I did with the book Winning Ugly 30 years ago, I went down to our local club, the Malibu Racquet Club, and I started studying club players. A couple of things that I see a lot of, you know, especially like the 3-5, 4-0 level, people set up really early, and a lot of times they get too close to the ball. When you set up so early, you can't make an adjustment. The ball might bounce higher, might bounce lower, might get in on you, might, you know, pick up a little pavement when it hits the ground. And I think a lot of players at the club level, I call, you know, on a little map of the tennis court. When you're in trouble, it's a good idea to play safe. Then when you got a ball in the middle of the court is maybe the chance when you should go for it. But I see so many club players, you know, especially a little bit lower, they get a ball in the middle of the court, that's when they totally relax, and they don't go for it, or they don't try to take the lead. And then when they're in trouble is when they try to pull, I call the 1 in 20 trigger. You know, you might make it once and miss it 19. So I think a lot of players got to understand what their strengths and weaknesses are, and I think it can help you compete a lot more.
Brad, how tough is it at any level, the professional level? And I know you talked about it on your first podcast about Andy Murray not being able to close out matches. And the recreational player, when they have a chance, you know, to close out a set on their serve or a match on their serve, how tough is it to get over that mental hurdle to continue to go after a match instead of being kind of complacent when you're in the lead to kind of shut things down?
This is one of the most common things you see from club players, juniors, high school players, is getting over that hurdle and obstacle when it's closing time and you don't close it out. I mean, my mentality is that, okay, we're even. Get back to work, get back to what you've been doing. But a lot of times when people are 5-4 up, don't close out a set, next thing you know, boom, 7-5, they're losing it, or losing their match. They're still thinking about it, you know, 15 minutes later. I mean, obviously, you know, I used to trick myself, you know, when I told Andre this about, you know, when I was down, you know, when I'm serving first set, I'm 5-4, and he goes, I'm telling myself I'm 3-5 down or 2-5 down. He goes, are you kidding me? How do you lie to yourself about the score? And it's like, honestly, so I don't relax. So I push myself. And what you need to do as soon as it gets back to even is tell yourself that. It's back to even. What's been working? And I always am one of the players, and as a coach, and so many players don't do this in a lot of sports. They focus on themselves. They actually don't think enough about their opponent's strengths and weaknesses. So that's as good as time as any when you get back to even is to think about what you've been doing well and what your opponent's going to try to do you. And, you know, just like your iPad or computer, you hit the refresh button and try to restart, refocus. And I like to say sometimes go take a walkabout.
And, Brad, when you mentioned that, and that's so fascinating because there's so many players in any sport that have the physical talent, right, that are gifted, and that gets you to a point. But the mental side of it maybe isn't talked about enough. Is that the real difference maker when you get to the elite level at tennis of whoever is mentally stronger compared to just the physical side?
It's an interesting question. I mean, you hear so many people say, oh, there's not a lot of difference between, you know, 5 and 100. There is a lot of difference skill set-wise between 5 and 100. But what sets, you know, the top few apart in any sport, I call the ability when things are as tight as they are that you actually have a clear mindset what you want to do. You don't fear, you know, the score. You don't fear losing. You actually think about things actually, if anything, slow down for them, for Rafa, for Fed, for the Jokers, you know, for the Tom Brady's, you know, somebody like a Wayne Gretzky, a Michael Jordan. Things slow down and they think clearer about what they want to do. And I think that, you know, positive mental and physical, even at the club level, you know, most of us think negatively. And when you think negatively, you will negativity. So I think, you know, at a lower level, club level, junior level, it's thinking about thinking forward. And way too many of us get caught up in what we blew 15 minutes ago. And a lot of times I tell players, you know, if you're thinking about something 15 minutes ago, you're not focused on what's in front of you, and losing that one point cost you many more after that.
Former tennis player, current tennis coach, ESPN analyst, and the host of the new podcast, Winning Uglier with Brad Gilbert. Brad Gilbert joining us here, Sportsnet Today, George and Andy on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Clearly, Brad, Canadian tennis, a very bright future. Bianca Andreescu, of course, winning the U.S. Open. But I want to ask you first about Denis Shapovalov and Felix Auger-Ali Aliassime. Out of those two guys, which one do you think has the brighter future?
Honestly, I mean, it's a tough call. I mean, they're both incredibly talented. A few years ago, I would have told you, first it was Denis, then it was Felix, then it was back to, at the moment, I do like the physical size of Felix at 6'4", and he moves incredible. So I do think that potentially he might have more upside, but I do like Denis a little bit fuel to the fire, a little Metallica, in that I think that he's one of those guys that when people all of a sudden bypass him or they say such and such has got a bind for you, I think that's what really charges him up. And I think he, for a guy, I know he lists himself at 6'1", I'd say maybe he's 6 feet tall in sneakers, has got huge power for his size. And I think that it's just the consistency level, actually for both of them, it's week in and week out, and I think that they will both make improvements, over the next 18 months. I think that, it's a solid race on who's going to get to top five first and potentially win a slam first. I mean, I think both of them are below skill set wise Bianca. I think had she been healthy in the fall, I thought she'd have been winning Australia already, but just her number one issue for her is nothing about her game. It's just being able to stay healthy. She hasn't been able to stay healthy for any period of time for years. It's amazing when she comes back how well she plays.
For sure. And Brad, getting back to the men's side on the Canadian angle for a second, you have Shapovalov 16th in the world, Felix at 20. Then there's Milos at 30. And has his time passed? Like, we talk so much about how the upside of Felix and Shapovalov there, but for Milos, is this a case where, okay, he kind of got as high as he's going to get?
That's a tough call. I don't know that I could ever see him back being at 3 in the world, but I got to tell you, I sat courtside in Melbourne. Never did I see Milos play as well from the return and the ground as I saw him play beating Tsitsipas in Australia. He played really well in Australia to the quarters and then ran into Djokovic. And a little bit like Bianca, he's another one that's had all sorts of difficulty staying healthy. And he's gone through a bunch of coaches. But I do think that the emergence of Felix and Denis has taken pressure off of him because now he's like, he's like the third guy, and I think the expectation is probably a little bit lower. The expectation is always there for you as your own self, as your own entity. I think that he could get back in the top 10, and I think that probably he wants to be the number one Canadian. I think all these things are still right there for him, but more than anything, he needs to stay healthy.
Brad, you've already mentioned twice that Bianca Andreescu clearly dealing with injuries. She was supposed to come back in that exhibition tournament earlier, couldn't do it, still battling some injuries, knee issue and a shoulder issue. Is that worrisome that for a tennis player, clearly those are some major parts of the body that are super important? Do you think this is just a bump in the road, or she kind of has to change her approach on what she's doing off the court?
I don't have one issue worrying about her game. She plays a lot like a Rafa, and she has so much skill set. It's amazing she went from basically Indian Wells to Canada, barely playing last year. She wins that tournament, wins the Open, and then now Since then, she's barely played. I mean, what I'm concerned about more than anything is the litany of injuries. It's elbow, it's shoulder, it's knee. It's different things, and they're not like just for a week. I mean, these things, you know, seem to be a little more serious. So I think more than anything that's priority number one, figuring out, you know, what she can do and what her team can do to be able to make her healthy. Because it's not like she's 30. She's so young, and you hope these things are fixable. You hope that, you know, this is not something we're talking about in 3 to 5 years that, you know, she's still got all these injury concerns. At least she's not getting surgery as of yet, but I will be concerned if one of these injuries all of a sudden doesn't go away and the next thing you know, she's out for another 6 to 9 months. That would be very concerning. I think she has an incredibly promising career the next 5 to 10 years, but it all starts, you know, with availability. If you're not available, you can't be putting, you know, to me, the Aussie Open was a good example. There was a major that I felt like was probably theirs for hers to be taken, but wasn't available. And now you start to, you know, hope for the Open that she's going to be okay because she pulled out of this exhibition. But that's my only concern with her moving forward. You know, I'm sure it's the same for her team. It's just being healthy because her skill set is off the charts.
Brad, we go from Bianca Andreescu and a major champion to Canada's sweetheart, at least for years and years and years, Jeannie Bouchard. Is there any chance she can be a top 50 player again?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's a realistic goal. You start with that, and obviously, you know, 2019 was a disaster. She lost a bunch of matches and lost her confidence. And if you can go back down to the Challenger Tour, win some matches, regain the confidence, a lot of players have refound their game. I don't know if she's going to get back in the top five, but you know what? Somebody with her skill set and capabilities, you start winning some matches, you it's like building blocks. Get to top 50, you know, and then when you get to there, it's probably from where she is, get from 350 to 150 to 50, and then you reassess your goals. But there's absolutely no doubt that she can get back in the top 50. Sometimes as players and coaches, everybody, the goals then, you know, okay, you just start thinking about, I got to get back here, I got to get back there, and it becomes a tough obstacle. But what you said is exactly with the first start, you know, get to top 50, cut your ranking in half from where it is. Obviously, we need to, you know, the pandemic to let up, especially in the States, so we can start having some tournaments and get back out there. But I would definitely, I'm a betting man, I would bet she gets back in the top 50 at some point.
Brad, we're short on time, but I have to ask you this question before I let you go. The greatest of all time conversation on the men's side, clearly Rogers in the lead with 20 majors, Rafa one behind with 19, and Novak just three behind at 17. When this is all said and done, does the man with the most tennis majors, is he considered the GOAT, or is it already Roger Federer?
Well, unfortunately, it's an incomplete sentence. And let's say 6 years from now, Djokovic is at 25, maybe even more.
Yeah.
And he has the most. Rogers fans will never, his fan base is like the biggest in the world. They will never say anything that Djokovic does is better than their guy. And Rafa has this massive fan base. And it's the same thing. So Djokovic fan base is way less. But if, you know, in 2030, if you're telling me that Djokovic is at 25, Rafa's at 22, and Fed's at 20, you know, and obviously the weeks at number one, all these things, and Fed was older, you know, when these two guys came, but I think the man with the most at the when it's all said and done of these three, because their careers were so intertwined and so many big matches against each other, I will say that that's probably the biggest difference. Head-to-head does matter, and actually Djokovic has the head-to-head versus both of them, And dramatically, he has the head-to-head versus both of them since 2011. And also, Winning Uglier, the new podcast, get it on Apple, iTunes, and Spotify. Hopefully you get that up in Canada.